Kilstrom, former president and bishop of the Minnesota Synod of the LCA. Our first time at Holden Village, we feel quite fortunate because we're here as a whole family. My wife and three teenage children all were able to work it out to be here at the same time. Very happy about that. We're going to be studying the prophecy of Amos in the Old Testament. And I'm very conscious of the fact that I have probably a very group sitting out in front of me. Some of you may have taught the book of Amos a few times. Some of you may have read it. Some of you may not be sure whether it's in the Old or New Testament. Some may never have known before today that there was a book in the Bible by the name of Amos. So we've got tremendous variety here. And during the course of the week, I will try to teach in such a way that those of you who know a lot about it might learn a thing or two. And those of you who have never really studied the book before might have your appetite whetted, your thirst increased so that you will study the book on your own after you have had the Holden experience. It occurs to me that I can't really teach Amos without first introducing you to myself, because as you get into Amos, you discover that he touches every one of us in a very deep and a very incisive way. You're going to find yourself stirred up by Amos. You're going to find Amos cutting you apart. You're going to find him giving you a little comfort here and there. But I really can't teach Amos without telling you who I am, because in the course of the week, I'm going to be making comments out of my own background and my own experience that I think make it important that I tell you a bit about myself. Native Minnesotan, born on a farm, 1931, part of the Depression. My parents already had four children, and it occurred to me that if they knew anything about birth control, I probably wouldn't be here. They certainly didn't need another child at that point in life. But I not only made it, but three more came along after. So we were a large family. I lived on a farm until the mid-30s, then moved into a small town in Minnesota about 60 miles west of Minneapolis. Had a very normal childhood in those days where most people were poor. And so when you think of poverty today, it's really quite different, I think, from what we knew in the late 30s, because practically everyone in the community was really in the same boat. Normal religious experience, ringing the bell, as I was telling Elmer with this morning, was quite a thrill, because my father was a church custodian. And every Saturday night at 6 o'clock, and then of course on Sunday morning at the time of the service, I had to ring the bell. And the most thrilling part of that was that it was a very heavy bell, and it was right next to the blower chest for the organ. And so on that last pull, you'd grab the rope high, lift you up about 6 or 7 feet, and step off on top of the blower box. And, that's the only part I missed this morning, ringing the bell. When I was about 14 years old, right after confirmation, went off to a camp setting like this, and had a very significant, very deep, a very moving religious experience. My baptism really came alive to me during that time at Bible camp. I don't think most people who observed me as a normal teenager might have guessed that very much was going on at that time, but it really was. And that became really a turning point, an opening up in my life that opened a lot of doors after that. A sense of ministry began to grow at that time, a sense of calling. When I read the prophet Amos and Jeremiah, Isaiah, read about their sense of calling, I identify with that, as I believe every Christian should, regardless of our calling. For me, it was into the ministry. And that kept growing until I spoke of it openly my first year in college. Had a good experience in college. Went to Augsburg College, and I think one of the reasons I'm attracted to Amos is because one of the people who influenced my life, I think as much as anyone during those years, was the sociologist Joel Thorstensen. Maybe you had him too. Maybe the others in the room had Joel. And I think I came to Augsburg typically rather fundamentalistic in my religious outlook, quite simplistic, convinced we could solve most of the world's problems simply by praying about them. And Joel was one of those people that kept after you until you finally began to realize that the Christian faith is very earthy. And so the field trips, rural sociology, or trips to the county jail, or courses on marriage and family, all of these things help me to see that if you really take the Christian faith seriously, that as a conservative Christian, you must be very radical in the way you make the application. And I, as you will see this week, as Amos unfolds, that's where I see Amos. He's very, we can use the term here, fundamental in his understanding of God and God at work in history, but also very radical in the way he sees that must be applied. Then on to seminary, Rock Island, again, very grateful for that because of the help it gave me in those years in understanding the scriptures as living, helping me to realize I didn't need a letter-perfect Bible in order to preserve its treasure. In fact, coming to recognize that here were many kinds of literature, and the more I began to see that, the more the scriptures came alive, and began to understand a prophecy like Amos as we studied it in the Hebrew text, and the rich symbolism of the way they thought and expressed themselves in the Old Testament times. Then four years of ministry. I should say, first of all, I interned in the inner city of Chicago. That was very shaping in my experience, too. An old Swedish congregation, which was now just a shell of what it had once been. The neighborhood by that time was almost entirely made up of Spanish-speaking people. And to see the a turmoil in a changing community, the poverty was very much of a learning experience for me. Then after seminary, 4 years in a small two-point parish in northwest Minnesota, where we now have a cottage and find that a nice place to retreat now and then. And to someone has said every Swede is really a butcher, a wood butcher. And that's where I do my wood butchering, all kinds of little carpenter projects that I just enjoy thoroughly, and a good diversion. Then back out east for 8 years of teaching at a small junior college in northern New Jersey. Graduate work during that time. Back to Minnesota to a town and gown congregation, and then to the Synod office 4 years ago. So that's a brief review of my life, but I think it's important to do that because some of the things, as I say, that we'll be dealing with this week come out of my background and experience. One final comment. Those of you that really get interested in Amos this week and want to do some work in the reference library, I noticed that there are at least three things back there that I think look very good. I know are good because I've read them. One is a book called The Message of the Prophets by Von Rod. He has about 10 or 15 pages on Amos. And then a survey of the whole Bible called A Book of the Acts of God by Wright and Fuller. And he has a section on the role of the prophets and a few things to say about Amos. And then in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible back there, you will find, I think, about 7 or 8 pages of background material on Amos. So if you get interested, that's a good place to look. Now, today we may not get very much beyond background and a little introduction to Amos because we are to break at 9:45, is that right?
No, 10.
Well, not till 10. Oh, good. All right. I want to begin on the wall here, and I hope you can all see it, because this is an attempt to put the Book of Amos in its historic setting and also in its geographical setting. I like to use timelines, and the timeline really begins behind the curtain. Can you all see this in the back? Is it too small, or can you make it a, it's borderline, huh? All right, well, I'll try and walk through carefully. You begin with creation, which is way out there someplace, and begin working this way on a timeline. Eventually, you get to Abraham, about in the middle of the window, approximately 1,800 years before Christ. And then you move on down to Moses at about 1,400 years before Christ. And now as we begin to move into this period, you begin to come into the time of the kings after the judges. And as you remember, there were three kings of Israel, Saul, David, and Solomon. So about the year 1000, we're coming to the end of the period of the three kings. And you remember from your Old Testament study that the time of Solomon was a time of great prosperity. The borders of Israel as a whole nation were extended far beyond what you can see here. And Solomon was the wise man of the world. Now, near the end of Solomon's reign, if you study that carefully, you begin to see that the cracks are starting to develop. And signs of decay and decline are already there. And so at the time of his death, the kingdom is split into two parts. If during the Civil War, for example, our country had remained divided between North and South, that is in fact what happened in Israel. They were divided into two kingdoms. The Northern Kingdom kept the name of the country, which was Israel, and the Southern Kingdom kept the name of the largest tribe, which was Judah. And over here on this map, you can see where they were approximately. Judah, down here, between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea, and then Israel, in this part up here, between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee, and during a period of time stretching out beyond that. Now, the prophecy of Amos is aimed at Israel. And so what we're going to do is simply make note of Judah here, but we make a dotted line here indicating that that's not where the focus will be. For this lesson, we'll more or less forget about Judah, except for one very brief reference. Our concentration will be on Israel. Even though Amos came from Judah, his prophecy is to Israel. All right, after the split, after Solomon in 929, Israel had a number of kings. And I have a line going down indicating that things were going from bad to worse. They had, I think, 19 kings in all in nation of Israel, and not one of them was really a good king. Some were better than others, but as a lot, they weren't very good. And so the line goes down and down until the year 801. And at that time, something happened over here that changed the fortunes of Israel and brought them into what would be called the Golden Age. And the thing that happened was that the nation of Assyria began to become more and more powerful just before the year 800 B.C. And she moved over and attacked Syria. And the two of them were locked in a very strenuous battle. They went the distance. And after it was all over, both of them were so weak that even though Assyria won the battle, there was really a power vacuum up in this part of the world. The result was that with a weak Judah from the south, none of the other nations particularly strong at that time, there was really a power vacuum for a period of about 40 or 50 years. And during that time, because Israel had a relatively good king by the name of Jeroboam II, things went well for them. They prospered. They were able to charge taxes without being harassed by their neighbors. And there really was a very good time for them. Now, this was the time during the Golden Age of Israel that Amos the shepherd, as we're going to learn in a few moments, comes down from the hills of Judah, goes to the city of Samaria, the capital city in Israel, and there gives them his prophecy. And basically, what he will be saying to them, as we're going to discover in the course of the week, is that you are living in a fairy world. You're living in a world of illusion.
It's a world where nothing is real. And you think that this kind of prosperity is going to go on forever. And you think you are God's pet. And you think that you can do nothing wrong. Or if you do something wrong, God will look the other way. And Amos's message is basically this, that I've got some bad news for you. And the bad news is that your time is limited. And that God is going to move in judgment. Now, Amos was active for a period of about 15 years, from 765 to 750. And then, in the year 746, a new king comes into power in Assyria by the name of Tiglath-Pileser, and he organizes the nation of Assyria. He puts together a very strong army. They began to move down in this direction. And finally, in the year 721, they attacked Israel and carried away practically everyone into captivity. The only people who are left are some of the poor people who intermarry with some of the Assyrian soldiers and eventually become the Samaritans. In other words, the half-breeds that were so despised by the official Jews down in Jerusalem. But for all practical purposes, Israel is wiped off the map, carried away and assimilated into Assyria. Only a few poor people are left behind in the land. Now, just to complete the picture here, as you may remember, Judah in the south endured for another more than 100 years, and then finally in 586, the nation of Babylon, located way over here, came and carried them into captivity. However, a remnant came back after 70 years. So the people of Jewish background today that you and I know are all descendants of the southern tribes that made up the nation of Judah. Israel, as we said, was pretty much wiped off the map. Now, what kind of, going back to the time of Amos, what kind of a period was it? Bible scholars pull out six characteristics of Israel during this time. And as we move through the week, again, these will keep popping up and we'll be talking about them. But I'll give you the six now that are called the marks of Israel during her period of the Golden Age. First of all, obviously, material prosperity. Never had they known wealth as they knew it at that time. Second, territorial expansion. Never had the borders of Israel been extended that far since the time of King Solomon. Third, great confidence in their military. There's evidence in Amos that these people are thinking that our military forces are so strong now that we simply can never be defeated. Fourth, there was a revival of, for want of a better term, formalistic religion. Evidence that people were flocking to the temple in Samaria, that there was worship, that they were giving quite generously for the sake of the temple and the sacrifices that were going on there. Fifth, widespread immorality, going hand in hand with their prosperity and their interest in formal religion. And then finally, great oppression of the poor. Bunrod says that the heart of their sin and their alienation from God can be centered in two things. First of all, contempt for God's law. In other words, saying that I know God said that, but after all, we are his children. We are his special pets, and therefore that doesn't quite apply to us. And that is contempt for the law of God. And secondly, religious complacency, sort of assuming again that if you keep up the externals, this can go on forever. Again, Bunrod said Amos' contemporaries were all in the grips of a cruel delusion. Wellhausen says there's something rotten in the state of Israel in spite of the holocaust days it enjoyed during Jeroboam II. So judgment did come, as we say, finally in the year 721. At this point, I want to add a word of caution.
because already, as I listed those six characteristics, I could almost see people lighting up saying, aha, sounds just like the United States of America. And we are going to make some applications, I suppose, in the course of the week. That's inevitable. But I think we do need to speak a word of caution. Putting Amos's message over America, United States, do we have any Canadians here? We don't, so I don't need to be quite so careful about that. We sometimes forget in the LCA that there are Canadians in our church too, and we keep talking about our nation and forget Canada. But let's just talk about the United States a bit. We really can't take Amos and put him like a straitjacket, his message onto America, because that never quite fits. History does repeat itself, but applications that are too literal can be dangerous and precarious. And you too have heard some preachers who have read Amos and they've run right to the pulpit and made an application. They assume it's automatic, and that is not always the case. So I say be cautious. In the course of our study, I will be speaking about what we sometimes call civil religion, and I hope that our discussion then will help us to put Amos into his proper perspective and understand better how we can apply his prophecy to our contemporary world. We will ask questions and we'll make applications as we get into the text, but a blanket comparison between two cultures is always dangerous. Now, then let's take and talk about Amos the man for a bit this morning. And if we get beyond that, we may be able to deal with one of the sections of the first chapter. We don't know a great deal about Amos. There are just a few basic facts that we can glean from the text, which will be helpful to us. And from that, I think we can paint a portrait that should be adequate. James Smart says that in a sense Amos paints his own portrait, so we'll let him do that for us today. I'm going to share with you five things that can be said about Amos on the basis of what we see here in the text. First of all, the obvious is that he tells us, and it says in one of the later chapters, in fact, in chapter 1 and also again later, that he comes from Tekoa in Judah, which is kind of interesting. Tekoa is a very wild, desolate, arid country down about here, south and east of the city of Bethlehem. If you have traveled in the Holy Land, I think you may have some sense just looking out of the tour bus, out across to the east from Bethlehem toward the Dead Sea, to know how desolate and, as we would sometimes say, God-forsaken that country really is. This is the area, by the way, where Bishop Pike of the Episcopal Church wandered off several years ago, and they found him sometime later. Had died in the wilderness out there. It is desolate, and people are warned not to walk in that area unless you really know what you're doing and where you're going. Well, that's the setting, this stark, barren land, the setting out of which Amos comes. Secondly, we know that he was a shepherd, and of course, Israel is one place where you can go today and catch the flavor of the shepherd life almost unchanged from Old Testament times. If you take the tour bus from Jerusalem down to Jericho, you have looked out the window if you've been there, and you see a shepherd with his horse and maybe a dozen sheep making his way off through the craggy wilderness. Now, those who know the Hebrew language well tell us that Amos was probably more than the shepherd of a small isolated flock. They think the language implies that he was more like a manager or the owner of several flocks. In other words, he was a business person. Paige Kelly, in his commentary, says that there's even enough evidence implied here that tells us that he may have been a specialist in the breeding and the raising of a small sheep that is small in size that was highly prized for its fine wool. What this would mean is that Amos, and the text shows evidence of this too, was very much a man of the world. He was not one who was not well-read or who did not have a keen intellect, but he was one instead that knew what it meant to go to the marketplace. He probably understood what it was like to dicker for a price, to be clever, to be wise, to be careful as a business person. Thirdly, we are also told later in the text, 7th chapter, that he was a dresser of sycamore trees. Now that's a strange expression for several reasons, because it's difficult to know what a dresser of sycamore trees actually did, or even what a sycamore tree is. We had sycamore trees in New Jersey and hated them because they had these huge leaves. Do you have them around here? I saw them on the West Coast now in Seattle. Huge leaves that fill thousands of garbage bags in the fall. And they also have the filthy habit of shedding their bark, and so you have to clean up after them periodically during the summer season. That is not the kind of sycamore tree we're talking about here. I saw one in the city of Gaza as we were traveling along the coast. Someone pointed it out to us. It looked more like an elm tree to me, and it is a tree with fruit on it. And we saw the fruit, which clings rather close to the trunk and grows in bunches. It looked almost like bananas, except for the size. The size is more like your little finger. The end of your little finger produces fruit about that size. And there's some interesting speculation about what a dresser of sycamore trees actually did. Some say that the end of the fruit has a hole in it, and so the insects would bore into or go into the hole and destroy the fruit. And so a dresser of sycamore trees was really a pincher of the fruit. He pinched closed that little hole in the end of the fruit to keep the insects from going in. At any rate, it was a seasonal job. When I was a kid, we'd eat tassel corn for 2 or 3 weeks during the summer. I'd see a few smiles from people who know that that dreadful job was like. It was a seasonal job. Again, traveling in the Holy Land today, in this day and age, we came to a village north of Jerusalem, and they described the olive harvest as much the same. That during that time, the town was shut down. Businesses were closed, and everybody had to go out and pick olives during that time. That may be what we have here, that Amos was a seasonal worker in the sycamore groves, and then during the rest of the time was a manager of a flock of sheep. The fourth thing we learn about Amos, very obviously from the text, is that he is blunt, but not uncouth. Put it that way, he's blunt without being uncouth. He leaves no question whatsoever what he has in mind. He says it with a sharp tongue, but when he has said it, you begin to realize that he has spoken the truth. And if you don't like it, you're going to have to argue with someone bigger than Amos. That's the kind of man he is. And then finally, Amos comes through to us as a man of high intelligence and unique ability. He is a poet of the first rank, able to shape words together in poetic style in such a way that they deliver the message that you need to hear. He is a communicator without parallel in the Bible, with the exception of our Lord himself. Being a man of the outdoors, he understands agriculture. He understands, of course, the language of the shepherds. He's able to take that background and use it for very down-to-earth illustration. And like Jesus, he is able to use those stories, as we sometimes call the parables, as truth traps. In other words, he catches your attention by telling you a story, and he draws you into the story, and you go along with him until finally he shuts the gate and you're trapped by the story. You can't really argue with Amos because you are facing now not the word of Amos, but the word of the Lord. And Amos has that unique ability of being able to make an application out of an earthy example. I like the comment of Plummer and then his quotation from W.R. Smith, which give you some insight into the fine ability of some of these shepherds from the hills. He says, in Eastern society, superior culture is not uncommon in connection with the poverty of shepherd life. And then he quotes W.R. Smith in this very significant word. At the courts of the caliphs, the rude Arabs of the desert were wont to appear without any feeling of awkwardness, and to surprise the courtiers by the finish of their impromptu verses, the fluent eloquence of their oratory, and the range of subjects on which they could speak with knowledge and discrimination. Among the Hebrews, as in the Arabian desert, knowledge and oratory were not affairs of professional education or dependent for their cultivation on wealth and social status. The sum of book learning was small. Shrewd observation, a memory retentive of traditional lore, and the faculty of original reflection took the place of laborious study as the ground of acknowledged intellectual preeminence. I like that description because I think that's our introduction to the man Amos. I like to draw comparisons between Amos and Moses, both men of fine intellect, a broad cultural background, and both were possessed of their knowledge of world affairs. They were not out of touch with what was going on in the world. And both were also shepherds, men who knew the loneliness and the solitude of the wilderness. They combined within themselves this quality of having been alone, and yet comfortable with the crowd. I'm reminded of Bonhoeffer's comment in Life Together, and I think it conveys to me the character of Amos. Remember Bonhoeffer said, let him who cannot be alone beware of community, and let him who cannot be in community beware of being alone. And in that combination of Amos, the isolated shepherd in the hillside, and yet able to walk into the cultural center of Israel and speak their language, that was the combination. I have a talk I've given at a couple of pastors' meetings based on Bonhoeffer's comment and a word to pastors on how we need to struggle to maintain that in order to have vitality in our ministry, to know solitude. You have to have that accent, the devotional life, the time apart, to know how to be alone. At the same time, ministry cannot be effective unless you're among your people calling vigorously to know what they're thinking, where their hurts are. And this combination is so evident in the prophet Amos. He knew how to be alone. He was not afraid to be with people. The last comment I would make by way of introduction before we move into chapter 1 is this, that even though we are going to be looking only at Amos this week, many people have pointed out that you probably should never study Amos without also studying Hosea, because they both come during the same period of time. In fact, Hosea started preaching about the same time and kept on preaching after things began to fall apart. And I'm going to take off my sweater if you don't mind. This is like sitting under a heat lamp here. And advertise our Minnesota camp. I'm doing this for effect. I sometimes said that you could characterize Amos as being like a heavy storm cloud with lots of strokes of lightning coming down, much judgment, a little bit of rain, a few showers of blessing, but you have to look kind of hard for them. Hosea, on the other hand, to me represents a cloud in which there is much rain, many showers of blessing. There is some judgment there, a few strokes of lightning, but they do contrast with one another. Hosea, you know, is the one who buys back his wife, and there's a great redemptive accent in that story. And as I say, people often say you ought to put the two of them together to get the total picture. But I hope that we'll see some mercy in Amos during this week as we move along too. For the sake of an outline, if you're interested in that, I have simplified it for my own thinking. I'm going to drag the blackboard over here for that. This is an oversimplification, but it may help you to remember some of the parts. That is, in chapters 1 and 2, you have 8 oracles. In chapters 3 through 6, you have 3 sermons. And then in chapters 7 through 9, you have 5 visions. That might help you to remember. You've got a combination of 5 and 3 here, which equal 8. So if you can think of 8 oracles, 3 sermons, and 5 visions. We won't look at all of them in detail during the week, but we will get to some of them anyway. Now, since I've got a little more time than I anticipated, I'm going to get into tomorrow's lesson just a little bit anyway, and we'll start to look at some of the oracles now that Amos speaks against the nations that surround Israel. Maybe I should move this back again and tell you where we're going so you have a good feeling for what's happening. These are the neighbors of Israel at that time. Making a circle around Philistia here, Edom down here, Moab, Ammon, Bashan is really an area, not a nation, Syria, Assyria, and Phoenicia. So those are the nations surrounding Israel. Now what Amos is going to do is really very clever preaching. He is going to begin, and he's going to pick on each one of these all around Israel and tell about their faults and explain the fact that all nations, not just Israel or Judah, but all nations are under God and responsible to Him. So he's going to talk about their sins, and the listeners in Israel will find it very delightful, because we always like to hear when someone else's sins are being described. So that's what he's going to do here for about 2 chapters. And then finally, he will zero in and talk about Judah. He'll start to get closer to home and describe her sin. And then, in the end, he will finally come to Israel herself and talk about her sin. But they don't know that, see? And maybe you should pretend you don't know it either. So you can enjoy how he zeroes in. Someone has compared this to the circling of the eagle. Zeroing in on his prey until finally it moves in on the exact object that it's looking for. All right. We call this part All Nations Under God. We have our Pledge of Allegiance, where we talk about one nation under God. I'm not so sure it was a good idea to change our pledge. There is a good side to it, but the bad side is it does feed I think a very unhealthy notion in our land that somehow America is God's pet, and that this nation has been uniquely blessed by God, which I don't really doubt, but also the fact that somehow we can do no wrong. And the point that Amos will make here is that every nation stands under God, responsible to Him, object of His mercy, but also, especially in this case, of His judgment. All right, let's take a look then at chapter 1, and we'll begin doing some reading here, and then move into at least the beginning of some textual study today. The words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa,
which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. And he said, the Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. The pastures of the shepherds mourn, and the top of Carmel withers. Now, that's the introduction to his sermon. And you or I, living outside of Israel, probably wouldn't appreciate what he's trying to say. But every preacher in the audience knows the basic number one lesson in homiletics, and that is that if you don't get their attention during the first minute or two, you might as well forget about it for the rest of your sermon. One teacher, a preacher, said, I always begin my sermon with the assumption that the people will be bored. And if you do that, then you've got to do something to catch their attention. All right, he does that with the phrase in verse 2, the Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. At this time, there were wild beasts wandering around in the land of Israel, and nothing would be more fearsome than to meet one of them on a path, as we might fear meeting a bear, a hungry bear, on a path during one of our hikes here at Holden Village. So he gets their attention by saying that the Lord is like a roaring lion. And so he makes them sit up and listen to him. The second part is more disturbing because he talks about the pastures of the shepherds mourning and the top of Carmel withering. The significance of that is that right here, leading from the center of Israel out to the seacoast here, is Mount Carmel. And on the slopes of Mount Carmel is where they had their most fertile land and where they raised their best crops. And the people knew that if there was a crop failure on Mount Carmel, then they were in for very difficult times. And they had had a time of prosperity without crop failure. And Amos's opening word is as though he's saying there's a drought on the way, and we are going to have a terrible time of poverty and hunger ahead of us. So he gets their attention by those opening remarks. All right, now then what he's going to do is move on paragraph by paragraph to talk about these neighboring countries and the sins that they have committed against God. Verses 3 through 5, I'm going to ask someone to give me an assist and read those. Anyone?
Thus says the Lord, for 3 transgressions of Damascus, and for 4 I will not revoke the punishment, because they have threshed Gilead with threshing sledges of iron. So I will send a fire upon the house of Hazael, and it shall devour the strongholds of Ben-Hadad. I will break the bar of Damascus and cut off the inhabitants from the valley of Ava, and him that holds the scepter from the Eden, and the people of Syria shall go into exile to Tyre, says the Lord.
Okay, we begin then with the country of Syria over here, which is named by its chief city Damascus. Sometimes when we talk about the United States, we simply refer to Washington, but that means the whole country. Here in this case, when he says Damascus, he's really talking about the whole country of Assyria, and he's going to talk now about the sins that this nation has been committing against God. You'll notice that he will begin each of these oracles with the expression for 3 transgressions, 4 for 4. Now, if you are a Bible literalist, you will look for 3 or 4 and you won't find them. The reason is because he doesn't really mean this. This is just a figurative expression. As though you and I are angry with someone and we say to them, I'm going to tell you a thing or two. We may tell them about 15 things. But it's just a Hebrew expression saying, for 3 or 4 things, I speak this word of judgment against Damascus or Syria. Now, to the listeners in the city of Samaria, they were especially glad to hear these words of judgment against Syria and Damascus, because they were the arch enemy. So again, Amos is showing how clever he is, because he is picking out that most hated enemy.
And they're all sitting up, and they're behind him, and they're saying with one voice, give it to them, Amos. They deserve every word of judgment you can speak against them, and whatever God does to them to punish them will be exactly what they had come. He's very clever at this point. He's really got the crowd with him. Now, what are they doing? Well, he describes something that is so terrible that you hesitate to talk about it, but the archaeologists tell us that there is evidence that they actually did this to human beings. And after Auschwitz, maybe we ought not to be all that surprised. But what he says here is that they took threshing sledges. You're going to have to endure some of my artwork now. They took heavy logs, made them into a block, a heavy block like that, and then they embedded the metal in the bottom, and then these were called, this is an ox in case you're wondering, they would hook them up to an ox, and they would actually drag these over the bodies of people, and they would do that until they were dead. More cruel than stoning someone to death. But these were the threshing sledges that were used ordinarily on the threshing floors to grind out or separate the chaff from the grain. But as you know, we who are made in God's image with tremendous powers of imagination are also fallen. And every time something good is developed, we discover an evil purpose for it. And so here's the story. If someone gets the idea, why not drag people under the threshing sledges of iron and do away with them in that way? And the message of God to them in this text is that you do not get by with those kind of things. At our LCA convention last week in Seattle, we developed and adopted a statement on economic justice. But justice is, of course, a much broader subject than that. That was only one aspect of it. And if you trace it back to its origin, justice is always rooted in the heart of God. One of my seminary professors, and others in the room will remember this because he said it so often, used to say to us in his class, if God cannot rule in mercy, he will rule in judgment. But rule he will. And that's the message of Amos to these people in Syria. You cannot get by with that kind of thing. And so God says to them, or through the prophet, says that he will break the bars of Damascus. In verse 5, I will break the bar of Damascus. And here again, very literal, very picturesque. As you know, the cities were walled at that time. They had gates that open, here's the wall, here. And then between the walls were gates that swung open. If you're looking at it from the inside, they would have receptacles for a bar here, and then they would slot them, and the bar would be dropped into that slot at night. And you can imagine as you're sitting in your little flat-roofed home when at night, sundown, you hear the bar dropping in, thud, and you sit back and relax and think, well, we're safe for tonight, that we don't need to worry too much. And the message of Amos is that God will break those bars, that there is no protection anywhere in the whole world for that people which is unjust and who treats others unjustly. I will break those bars. So the message is one again that injustice reaps judgment. One more in the moments that are left. Gaza, chapter 1, verses 6 through 8. Again, would someone read those verses?
Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Gaza and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Because they carried away captive the whole captivity, which delivered them up to Egypt. But I will send a fire on the wall of Gaza, which shall devour the places thereof. And I will cut off the inhabitants from Ashdod, and him that holdeth the scepter from Ashkelon. And I will bring my hand against Ekron, and a remnant of the Philistines shall perish, saith the Lord God.
Philistia is down, Gaza is the capital city of Philistia, down here along the seacoast of the Philistines, who were so feared by the Israelites. They are an immigrant people. They come from an island called the Island of Castor. I don't know if that would be Crete or Cyprus, but anyway, they came and made a beachhead here earlier, established a nation. And they were some of the earliest ones to use metal in warfare. So they were a very feared neighbor. There are four principal cities in Philistia. They are Gaza, which would be the capital. We've been hearing about the Gaza Strip now for years and years, the buffer zone between Israel and Egypt today. Other cities are Ashdod, and if you visit that today, you find it to be a very modern city. Seaport where they export great amounts of mineral from the Dead Sea for fertilizer all over the world, Ashkelon and Ekron. Now, according to verse 6, her sin seems to be that of slave trading, which is very common at that time. The unique thing about this is that the text indicates that they carried into exile a whole people. Normally, slave trading through the centuries has been selected. You would go in and choose the most healthy and take them away and leave the old and leave the very young. The indication here is that they took whole cultures, swept them away, and transported them to another place. Slave trading and the use of slaves was very common in the ancient world and up until relatively modern times. The pyramids of Egypt built by slaves. Stone carvings all over the Mideast indicating that slave trade was simply taken for granted. Some say that even in Paul's time, one-third of the men in the working age were living as slaves. But as we say here, the sin seems to be that they took a whole people and carried them into slavery. Again, it's injustice. God said, I will turn my hand against you. Literally, it means I will slap you back and forth like this, and then the back of the hand like this, and like this. I will turn my hand against you. And then the worst of all, the remnant shall perish. In other words, we talk about endangered species. The indication is here that every evidence of the people of the Philistines will be wiped out from the earth. Judgment did come. Again, archaeology is helpful to us. Tiglath-Pileser, whom I talked about earlier, kept a diary. And in his diary, 734, his annals are recorded this statement. Gaza I captured, its possessions, its gods I carried away, and his royal image I set up. And so the implication of Amos's message here is that your injustice to others, in this case in the form of slavery, will catch up with you later, and you will pay the penalty for that. Do you need to make an application? How much of the sorrow and the turmoil and the heartache that we see, especially in urban America today, is due to the fact that we're simply paying the price for the injustice and the sin of the generations, and in many ways continuing that same injustice. We're going to stop at that point. I think we're right up to the 10 o'clock hour. Somehow during the week, I'm going to try and open this thing up to get more discussion. I wanted to lay groundwork today to make sure that you got a good feeling for Amos and his message and where he's going. As the week unfolds, I'll try to stop at about 9:45, and we'll use that last 15-minute period or so for discussion. I would suggest that it would be helpful for that purpose if you would now, with this brief introduction and the outline I gave you, during your leisure time, read the book of Amos. It wouldn't take more than probably an hour to read it in one setting. I recommend that because then you can see the whole of it.